Welcome to Built to Play, Games and Technology for the Arts Inclined. I'm Ron McBally.
And I'm Daniel Rosen. This week, we gawk at HoloLens, rubberneck at Club Nintendo, and stare agape at esports.
Plus, it's quarterly earnings reports time, which means that we've got more numbers than we know what to do with.
But first, Daybreak Game Company totally makes games and is also not a front for the mob, we promise.
So, despite that name sounding like it totally is a front for the mob, it actually used to be Sony Online Entertainment, the creator of beloved franchises such as The Matrix Online and Star Wars Galaxies.
Or EverQuest, something you may have enjoyed.
They had one or two players for that game.
There was like one person who likes EverQuest.
Yeah.
Ever.
So, okay.
I prefer ElfQuest.
Well, okay. They still release expansions for EverQuest, I believe.
Yes, they do. It's still running. EverQuest 2, at least.
EverQuest 2, one of the most popular games online. Anyway, so their developer, EverQuest, PlanetSide, DC Universe Online, H1Z1, riding that old Daisy train, and a bunch of MMOs that you've never heard of, has been sold to supervillain Columbus Nova.
Which, yeah, either a James Bond villain or more of a game company sounding name than Daybreak Game Studios. Daybreak Game Company, not studios. Yeah. They're not a studio, they're a company.
Daybreak Game Company, which is also not a front for drugs, will be working on the games they made as Sony Online Entertainment, changing nothing, but will also be developing for Xbox and mobile. The best part of this being that the way we found out that they would definitely be publishing for Xbox was their lead, the head of the studio, tweeted, "I can't wait to make games for the Xbox," which is a classy way to start.
I wonder if stuff like EverQuest is going to make it to Xbox. I imagine Sony owns copyrights on that somewhere.
Maybe. I don't know. Like,
imagine Sony cares.
I can't imagine Sony cares because this stuff didn't... EverQuest 2 made a lot of money, but, like, not enough that I think anyone...
Not enough in the last decade.
Yeah, and, like, EverQuest Next might... I mean, it looks like an interesting game. It's got them voxels, but, like, it's such a risky bet considering, like, what was it? Elder Scrolls Online, the venture that wasted 2 years of Bethesda's time to make a online multiplayer game out of everyone's beloved Skyrim. Mm-hmm. That just went free to play and was a disaster. That game is terrible. So,
yep. Daybreak is currently working on EverQuest Landmark, which you mentioned. We actually haven't seen that in a while.
Yeah.
Haven't seen that in a bit. If I were to hazard a guess, might be rebranded as something else and show up on Multiplat.
That'd be funny. The,
NeverQuest. It'll be but Elf, yeah, no, you know what? It'll be ElfQuest Landmark.
They've been releasing trailers and such, and they sometimes go on Twitch and play it for a bit. And I think at one point they said, "Hey, join us in an alpha thing." But yeah, I don't think they've been like showing that game as like, "Hey, here's our next new feature," or "Here's our next new."
SOE, or Sony Online Entertainment, was a money-losing venture for Sony as MMOs have slowly withered on the vine. Spinning them off as their own company makes a lot of sense, though I can't really imagine they'll last long at all without a major publisher backing them up.
So who wants to make an MMO? I mean, I've got a dollar.
I've got none. They don't pay me anything. I'm an intern. I'm an intern and the last one left.
They give you the administrative accents. You can burn that website to the ground, Daniel.
taking you all with me. So here's what I want to ask about.
Yeah.
What do you think Daybreak Game Company actually does? Because there's no way on earth they make MMOs. No one makes MMOs. This is the world's worst front.
So things that Daybreak Company could be. Daybreak Game Company could be, well, okay, so because game is in the title, they can't make games.
Of course, so that'd be too obvious.
The my bet is either front for esteemed Colombian drug lord, Columbus Nova, or...
Connecting the dots.
Or a front for the Chinese triads.
I think they're the company that manufactures Thomas Mulcair's beard.
Why manufactures his beard?
It's too glorious of a beard. Listen, I'm not going to comment on the opinions
of the leader of a New Democratic Party.
I'm not going to comment on his opinions. I'm not going to get political here, but I think he definitely has the best beard in Canadian politics, if not politics, period.
He definitely has the best French beard in Canadian politics.
Oh, certainly. I'm saying that's what they do. I mean, listen, because if you knew the company that manufactured that beard, wouldn't you want to get all over that? They need to stay exclusive. They can't be fielding orders. He needs a new beard every day.
Okay.
He's on television all the time now.
He's on television talking about that new daycare thing, but clearly he's on there to get the beer. He's there as a because of his the lobbying efforts for
right,
the beard
from the
industry.
Daybreak Beard Company. Beard Break, Day Beard.
Day Beard Beard Company?
Day Beard Beard Company.
That seems like a bit of a wordy name.
Well, so Daybreak Game Company, but, you know, that's what they goddamn picked. That's what they picked.
So, I mean, part of this is that I guess MMOs don't make much money these days. Most of these games are going free to play. I mean, not quite. You still have to buy the base. All the
okay, so that drives me absolutely crazy. Can we? And this is a weird time to be complaining about MMOs, but I was kind of interested in trying Final Fantasy XIV.
Right, but the you still have to buy like
you still have to buy a
bucks.
$60 game, and then on top of that, pay a monthly subscription. Like,
yeah,
that's not going
to
happen.
No, no. Like, and it's very hard to try out an MMO with a subscription fee these days because you're making that upfront investment of $60, and then you're making the monthly investment of $30, which I mean, it just runs you dry at this point, and
yeah.
You don't have that much time to play a single video game. We're not at that point in where people have like it used to be that games didn't come out that as often, or that people had very specific tastes, or there was a very specific kind of player who was out there. So MMOs were very popular because, hey, there's a lot of people who have just nothing but free time.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I'm pretty busy. I know you're pretty busy. How much time would you actually invest into Final Fantasy XIV?
Oh, absolutely none. It would have been a curiosity, right? And
yeah.
I would have willingly paid, you know, $30 to have a month of Final Fantasy XIV and played it for a month and never touched it again.
Yeah, but meanwhile, I wonder if that's what they expect the bulk of their revenue stream is, to be people trying out the game at $60 and then hoping that they stay along to whatever expansion packs they can charge for, because
see,
the subscription fee is just a failing idea.
But I feel like Final Fantasy XIV makes its money off the subscription fee, because I feel like it has actually a consistent user base. I think
right.
Final Fantasy XIV is unique in that circumstance, though.
It might be because
you can point to WoW being, you know, free to play for 20 levels as an example of why Final Fantasy XIV is unique.
Yeah, and I mean, Final Fantasy XIV, part of it is that that game is weirdly popular in Japan, but I bet it's played a lot in game cafes,
mm-hmm.
in net cafes, as opposed to in people's homes.
Mm-hmm.
Just because I feel like, one, Japanese people don't own a lot of PCs, and two, or we don't own a lot of PCs of any power in them.
Nor do they have really, you know, fantastically cheap internet access.
Yeah, so instead, it probably makes more sense for them to go to a place where they have that stuff installed
yeah.
already and just hang out there.
See, my guess is that it's played a lot in cat cafes.
In cat cafes?
Yeah.
So most of the people on Final Fantasy XIV confirmed are cats.
They're playing Mikote.
Yep.
I know Final Fantasy XIV races.
So
fight me. Fight me with the Mikote.
Speaking of fighting, today I learned that being gay is a cheat code, or that's at least what the headline wrote here, Daniel. I blame you for any repercussions.
For making anybody say, listen, we do this after I do a full work day. I get punchy.
So, from the eSports Be Crazy file, here's a doozy. That
I'm really making you say terrible things today.
Yeah.
So an esports league in the Philippines limited the number of lesbian, gay, and trans women who could compete in their women's-only League of Legends tournament. The reasoning, quote, some players might have an unfair advantage, end quote, if they identify as LGBTQ. That's insane. That's genuinely crazy.
So what was the one before this? It was the league in the Philippines, not Philippines,
yep.
It was a league in Finland
yeah.
who said that, oh, you can't, women, we can't, like, we're limiting the number of women to this tournament. Or
right.
There's a women-only tournament.
There's a women-only tournament and a men-only tournament because never shall the twain meet. It's like, there's no difference in strength. There's literally no, there's nothing that changes here.
So I feel like that might be misguided. Like, at the very least, you could point to, like, well, sports are divided between men and women, but what sports league is divided between straight and gay people? Like, I mean, it's not like the javelin toss is like, well, that's very phallic, so we can't have gay people in this.
Oh,
or wrestling, that guy might, you know, he might get a little frisky in the arena. We don't say that.
Ugh.
Even though that is, I mean, offhand, it is the sport where people are actually touching each other. Like,
so, Garena Philippines, the tournament, stated, quote, for any competitions, we seriously look at ensuring there's a fair level playing field for all participants. And there are arguments and concerns from other participants who dispute that lesbian, gay, transgendered women members may probably have some unfair advantage, and I want to be the first or 7,000th person to say that transgendered isn't a word.
It isn't?
You can't say transgendered.
Transgender
people, trans women, trans men, or just women and men if you don't want to necessarily get involved in all the trans issues. They identify as women, they identify as men. Transgendered implies that you have made them trans somehow, because you have gendered them. Transgendered isn't a concept.
I was transgendered.
Yeah.
I was attacked by a rogue trans. And
It's infuriating and nonsensical. League of Legends is often dominated by male players, so an all-women's tournament isn't the world's worst idea. It's, you know, it's good to encourage diversity within the scene. However, turning around and claiming that lesbians are a cheat code is not a good idea and does not promote diversity. It promotes us mocking you.
That is, I mean, that's the exact opposite of what diversity is. Like,
it's really gross.
That's really stupid. Like, more than gross, it's just idiotic. Like, why would you do that? Like, I can't think of a definitive, like, what is the unfair advantage? Like, I can't, like, what is the advantage? But
lesbians have an extra joint in their finger.
Is that true?
Makes you better clicking.
Okay, that makes sense. But I mean, like, it's also gay people. So what do they have?
Sorry, it's a women's tournament. They say gay and lesbian women.
Right.
Are the same thing. But I might be missing something.
That just might be extra insulting. The tournament has since went back on their ruling, I guess?
Yeah, they claimed they didn't mean to offend anyone, but how in the hell did they think this was a good idea in the first place? Who got around and said, you know what, we should do?
It's like, okay, so I fear the gays, so we should probably separate them because of God.
Well, not separate them, right? Ban them. There's no separate gays-only tournament. There's nothing that offensive. They're just saying that you can only have one lesbian or trans woman per team because they provided an unfair advantage.
How would you even enforce that?
Well, like, they said I didn't mention here, but violators would be banned from their tournaments for a year.
But how would, I'm thinking like,
so walk up to each person?
Like walk up to each person and smell them?
A picture of Sharon Stone in Basic Instinct and see how they react? I can't tell if that was offensive or not. I'm sorry.
Sharon Stone wouldn't detect everyone, but you're right. It would be, it's one of those 80%. It's like a polygraph.
Right.
Like it's a solid 60, right?
Mm. It trends well.
Anyway.
Hashtag Sharon Stone.
That was a terrible idea from conception to end. Club Nintendo's this on a similar vein, although not to a big extreme. Club Nintendo's always been kind of useless, but now we get to say goodbye.
In a beautiful Viking funeral that actually has the service in flames. It's kind of impressive. So as Nintendo's profits have been spinning out, it seemed almost inevitable that their oft-ignored customer rewards program would be getting the axe.
Club Nintendo launched in 2008 in a much simpler time. Back then, we thought we'd have parity with totally rad rewards Japan was getting. Of course, most of what the Americans got from Club Nintendo was utter junk.
We never got the really great Wii Classic controller shaped like a Super Nintendo controller. We never got the replica gold Mario Kart trophies.
Instead, we got the Grill Off with Ultra Hand, a WiiWare game no one wanted when it was new.
They're still selling it. You want Grill Off? Listen, Grill Off with Ultra Hand is only available from Club Nintendo, so if you want it, better act fast.
As the year went on, it's kind of like amazing how bad these gifts get with the elite status. Once upon a time.
Club Nintendo, we didn't really explain. Every time you bought a Nintendo game, you could register it and get a certain amount of coins.
It's like whenever you buy a piece of software, it says, "Hey, do you want to register this?"
I was thinking it's like when you go to a sandwich place and they stamp your card, and the seventh time you get a free sub.
Yeah, yeah. It's somewhere between there and like, "Hey, do you want to like sign into our service and get technical support?" I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Except sometimes you get a game in which you grill off with
Ultra Hands.
Yep.
So, but basically the idea is that I think, like, 3DS games were worth 40, and Wii U games are worth 60. Like, handheld games are 40, console games are 60, and a prize is somewhere in, like, the 400 to 500s.
Right. Air miles.
Air miles. That's a much better example. The elite gift, so you reached, I believe, by getting 300 coins was to get gold, and then another 500 on top of that would get you platinum. They had an elite status gift. Once upon a time, Nintendo gave away unique Hanafuda card decks and, like, these fancy trophy maquettes of Mario, Luigi, Peach, Yoshi, Toad, and Bowser. Last year's elite gifts were just a bunch of regular virtual console games I could buy with my real money. It was bad. Last year, I got the Majora's Mask soundtrack.
Oh, nice. Yeah. I didn't realize that you're a long-time Club Nintendo member.
I have been putting in the points because I actually kind of like getting the free games. And I used to like getting like the fancy physical gifts.
Right.
You know, I have the Hanafuda card deck. There's a lot of stuff that's really nice that they used to have. And now it's just mostly been, I don't really want to spend money on this virtual console game, but I'll take it anyway for 200 coins. But now I sit upon a throne of 1,560 absolutely useless coins.
Oh, that's intense. So there actually used to be exclusive games in that thing. So the DS game and watch collections or Tingle.
Japan got two exclusive Tingle games to Club Nintendo, one of which was...
By the way, Tingle is the weird Japanese mascot,
elf man.
In Zelda that people seem to hate here, but is incredibly popular in Japan.
Yeah, he's just sort of an uncomfortable 40-year-old man who dresses like a fairy.
Yep.
Wears tights and underwear.
Highly amusing in Japan, but...
Here is just sort of unsettling and upsetting.
Real creepy.
Yeah, but so he stars in two Club Nintendo exclusive games in Japan. Tingle's freshly picked Rosie Rupee Land, wherein Tingle hires bodyguards to help him explore dungeons. And Tingle's Balloon Fight, which is a remake of the NES Balloon Fight, but with Tingle. Europe got Tingle's Rosie freshly picked Rupee Land. Japan also got, for example, this game that I can't remember the name of, where you played as a group of Power Rangers that only responded to voice commands. It's really bad. It's awful, but it's super fascinating.
That sounds great.
For example, also Japan got the Advance Wars DS game that they never got, that only came out in the West. They got that as a Club Nintendo game, like, last year.
Right, right.
Stuff like that.
So the slow decline of these physical rewards kind of makes sense when you put it this way.
Yeah.
In that, like... They cost money to actually like make, and you have to stock them in a warehouse, and free shipping probably wasn't so hot for their bottom line.
Yep.
But the game stuff, I mean, they probably could have given you better incentive than virtual console games that you could already buy.
So that's the thing. I feel like the virtual console game isn't half bad as a person who really likes virtual console game. I like virtual console a lot, but because of that, I'm a person who buys a lot of virtual console games.
Right.
So it's sort of like I am the person this would be good for, but it's useless to me.
Okay.
I really think that the games they were offering were part of the problem, why people weren't interested in it. They say they're going to be doing something new. I will bet you any amount of money there'll be digital games only on that service because that costs nothing.
They basically like unceremoniously act this and like you'll get something in the future.
Yep, something. We don't know what. In the meantime, you can still register Club Nintendo codes until June 30th and redeem the final batch of over 100 game rewards and a couple exclusive physical rewards, including some Majora's Mask 3D related stuff, including a Majora's Mask tote bag if you really want to show off to all your NPR tote bag and friends.
Oh man.
And a Fierce Deity Link puzzle. Jigsaw puzzle.
I could actually go for a tote bag.
I was thinking about it for a second, and I thought, this costs the same amount as Donkey Kong Country Returns 3D, a game I would actually want to play, and I have no use for a tote bag in the world.
Well, like, the appeal of a tote bag is knowledge of the tote bag, not necessarily the use of the tote bag.
So that's the thing, I know it exists.
Right.
It'll be $3,000 on eBay in a couple of years, but...
Yeah, that's fair enough.
So there's over 100 virtual console games they're putting out on that thing right now. So if you're a person with like 200, 300 Club Nintendo points, there's a couple things that are worth it. I would say Kid Icarus Uprising and Donkey Kong Country Returns 3D are both 700 points on 3DS.
The Wonderful Woman 101, which is it's not a great game, but if you're getting games, if you don't have games on Wii U and you want more.
And you want a free one.
Yeah.
700 coins for Wonderful 101 is crazy good. As for virtual console games, you can get Earthbound, Super Metroid, Link's Awakening, and Wario Land 2. They're all like 200 coins and spectacular games. You can't really go wrong with them. There's some great offers in there, so long as you aren't me and bought them all with your real money. Seriously, Nintendo, just give me something I haven't... Like, that's the thing. Like, the stuff I haven't purchased from there is, like, Kersploosh, which is not a game I made up.
That seems like... That just seems like this is your fault, though. Yes. That doesn't seem like Nintendo...
Oh, are you kidding me? I have 1,000-something coins. I'm going to get Donkey Kong Country Returns 3D. I'm also going to get Tokyo Crash Mobs, which is a puzzle game with FMV graphics.
Fantastic.
Where you play two tourists coming to Japan who want to get rid of all these long lineups so they smash people together until they explode.
Well, that's a dream.
It's all live action. Published by first party Nintendo.
Well, hopefully this isn't something we get to see in the upcoming Microsoft HoloLens, because that would be horrifying beyond all belief. So at an event about last week or 2 weeks ago now, it's Microsoft decided it was high time they entered the VR race and invented AR glasses.
Yep.
I think they got the first letter wrong there. But in any case,
just a little.
Joining the ranks of Sony's Project Morpheus and the Oculus Rift, we now have the HoloLens, the harbinger of the sci-fi future your mother's always been afraid of.
So the HoloLens is a self-contained piece of equipment. It's not connected to a computer. There's no wires. It's just a big, dumb thing that sits on your face.
And it's like, it's got a computer all locked in there. And the thing is, as it turns out, it is not like a self-contained vision, what you're seeing. It's
yeah,
not like
clear
a clear
lenses.
Yeah, so what you're seeing are, as they've tried to pitch it, holograms, or more likely, augmented reality goggles, except they're so huge, they extend from your face what it looks like about a fist, that maybe a little bit awkward to go around any setting that's not an office.
Just a little. Yeah, I have a feeling Microsoft doesn't expect these to leave your room.
No. It's, like, basically, the examples they gave were, like, Minecraft, where you could just, like, hey, look, there's a pile of Minecraft stuff.
Legos, and it's an infinite Lego box in your room.
You can kick it. And, like, oh, they kicked it and it broke. Yay!
Yep. Or you can have an electrician, like, look over your shoulder or whatever.
Yeah.
That was part of their demo. How exciting.
You know, I want the demo of, hey, what are you doing?
You shouldn't be eating those Oreos.
I don't know what you think those are.
Well, I'm seeing them as magical fire goblets.
That's why I ate 50 of them.
All these Oreos have QR codes that change them into something else.
Oh, God, the horrifying future of augmented reality. Okay, basically, it displays a digital image in the real space around you as if they were holograms. I mean,
they're really just 3D models. It's imagine if you could see, like, you're the 3D models in a game in the real world, but you had to wear a giant mask over your face to do it.
The project's been around for a while. It started as these hologram goggles that eventually turned to Kinect, and Microsoft is definitely positioning this as the next step of their Kinect brand, if you're looking for, like, the evolutionary line here.
If you're a thought thinker social guru. Probably not directly, considering that they've basically killed the Kinect forever.
Yeah, they're never gonna say, if you love the Kinect...
This is the Kinect 3. No, this is... There's a reason they're going for a different name, but it's very much in the family of the Kinect.
Yeah, it's the... Crazy nephew.
Yeah, and speaking of crazy, we don't really know, like, all crazy VR AR tech, if this will work in person.
Yeah, I mean, like, Google Glass is way less ambitious than what this is. It doesn't display 3D models. It doesn't display...
I like how Google Glass took their thing off the store shelves, like, a week before this announcement, thinking, like, man, you know, this is too obnoxious. And it's like, no, now it seems way less obnoxious.
Yeah, it's not like... I think it's literally two layers of glass.
Yeah.
So it's literally not too, like, a giant headset that you put on your face and attempt to pretend that you're in a magical fairy princess land.
Oh, boy, I'd play that.
But like, by comparison, like, Google Glass, like, it's just, like, little signs, like, hey, you got a text message, or, hey, you're filming your friends around you, maybe you should stop that, they just told you to stop, please get out of the bar. But this is, like, this is, you have 3D models, that are blowing up in front of you, and as such, maybe they're going for, like, I can see electricians, or,
I can see this having some really interesting business-related applications.
Yeah, like, architecture guys, like,
yes.
Hey, here's your building. Like,
exactly.
This is what,
I think there's some really cool applications that Microsoft was sort of talking about with modeling, with being able to pull stuff up, charts, and data. I think it's really great from a business perspective, which makes sense for Microsoft. I think it's utterly useless from a consumer perspective.
Right now, I think it looks like a product that won't be, I mean, like,
I also don't think it's actually ready the way they're saying it is.
No. Like, this is something that they put up to say, hey, look, guys, we're working on something. Mm-hmm. We're working on this.
Ignore Microsoft 10.
Yeah.
Windows 10.
Yeah. Welcome to the future. This is, but honestly, we're not going to see anything. We're not going to see anything, like, actually physical out of this.
At least until next year and probably later.
I'd say 5 years, man. This is their project seems... It's just you can't go to market with that thing. Like, the way it's so big and obtrusive. Like, if you look at the early Oculus models, the Oculus models were very simple, but they were very... They conveyed what they did early on. This, like, hey, look, you're on a roller coaster. You put your head around. Oh, God. Okay, you had the adventure done. This looks like they don't quite, like, have the story of laid down right, of, like, the experience you're going to have when you put them on. And on top of that, they don't have, like, the conception of the environment in which you're going to use it in. Mm-hmm. So, like, the Oculus, very clearly you're going to be tethered to a computer. Mm-hmm. Like, you're hopefully...
There's very understandable and strict limitations to it, and therefore strict limitations of what you imagine yourself doing with it.
Yeah, so as a result, like, the HoloLens just kind of feels like this vague product that where they haven't quite figured out. Like,
see,
here's
I
a ton
like...
of a million applications that we
right.
could have.
I feel like The Verge pretty much nailed it. Because they had an article about the possible applications, and I think they figured out there's a Steve Ballmer simulator. Wherein you look in a mirror and your face is replaced by Steve Ballmer. And everybody, you just hear the sound overlaid everybody with just calling you Steve Ballmer. And you take off the mask, and then you realize you've been Steve Ballmer the whole time. And he's free.
Okay. So, speaking of Steve Ballmer, if we're talking about things that are unbelievable, we might as well get to these Q3 and Q4 numbers.
We got some numbers.
So, it's the end of quarter three, which means it's everyone's favorite season, or if you're in the case of most of these manufacturers, not your favorite season. Earnings reporting.
Yep.
So, Sony, first one of the list, how much did they sell of their PS4s?
6.4 million PS4s between October and January, bringing the total up to 18.5 million worldwide.
So, how does that compare against last year?
Last year, Sony sold 4.5 million PS4s, so this is a step up. The PlayStation section of Sony saw a 16.8% sales increase up to 4.3 billion. Profits are also up. So PlayStation,
yeah,
pretty well.
It's a pretty good investment. Probably not saving the drowning
Sony as a whole. No, yeah. Absolutely not. Q3 for Sony looks terrible. But Sony Gaming Division looks great.
It's weird how Kazurai managed to fix this one little part, and then now he's on top of Sony, and his the whole thing is like, oh, no,
plug as many leaks as he can with his fingers.
God, I thought, like, I bet he fought the PlayStation division, taking over from
Kitaragi,
he thought that was probably the biggest nightmare he could ever ordeal. He did not realize what was happening at the macro stage.
Just a couple steps up.
Yeah. Anyway, so what's up with Nintendo?
Nintendo says they've moved the 3DS past the 50 million mark with 7.08 sales this quarter. Nintendo also says their growth is slowing significantly in North America and Europe, whereas Japan is booming. Ain't that just the way?
The Wii is stagnating, as you might imagine, with 19 million sales.
Sorry, 1.9 million.
Sorry, 1.9 million
not
sales.
19 million sales for the Wii U?
Whoa!
Yeah.
So up to 9.2 million sales worldwide.
Which is half of the GameCube. So we're great getting job. There, guys. Just keep on trucking.
So the thing that people always mistake about these consoles is that in the time that they have been around, they have been selling better quarter by quarter. Mm-hmm. Than their predecessors in the same time frame, except for the Wii, which just like sold like hotcakes.
Right.
The PlayStation 3 and the Xbox One, which we'll get to, have been doing better.
No, the Xbox One has not been doing well. The 360.
Oh, it has not been.
No,
okay,
no,
we'll
no.
get to that. I guess
it's been dropping.
But the in any case,
Xbox One in general has been outpacing the 360 at this period. But this was before the 360 picked up.
Right. Right. That's true. In any case, the Wii U, when you think about it. I mean, what is it? 3 years now?
Yeah.
So the GameCube had a solid 5 years on it. That's kind of decent.
It was 2006. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not so bad, all things considered. I just think that now we're trying to. The thing is, the numbers are up because we're judging by different standards. Gaming is just a complete, much bigger industry as a whole. So maybe that old number isn't as valid anymore.
And plus, I mean, the PS2 isn't out here eating everyone's lunch this time. and so Nintendo's also the only company that offers their software sales because they're a software developer as well as a console manufacturer. So here's some crazy numbers. Pokemon pushed almost 10 million units. That's Omega Ruby Alpha Sapphire. Smash Bros. 3DS got 6 million.
Two-thirds of people who own a... Two-thirds of people who own a 3DS, got Pokemon?
There are 50 billion, so a fifth.
Oh, sorry, a fifth.
A fifth.
My numbers are wrong. Smash Bros. 3DS got how many?
That was, I lost my numbers here. Smash Bros. 3DS sold, I really lost my numbers here, 6 million. Smash Bros. For Wii U also sold, I believe, another 3.9 million. So Smash Bros. As a whole sold 10 million. 3.9 million, by the way, again, a third of Wii U owners own Smash Bros. Mario Kart 8 pushed 4.7 million, more than half of the Wii U's install base.
Well, you win some and you lose some.
So software, I mean, software wise, they're raking it in, but you have to imagine again. Mario Kart 8 sells 4.7 million. Mario Kart Wii sold, I think, 50 million.
And as for Microsoft, the Xbox One stands in the lead with 6.6 million consoles sold this season with a revenue of 26.5 billion? Wow, yep. That's pretty good.
That's crazy.
The Xbox sales are, however, down year over year.
Yeah, from 7.4 million last year. Microsoft dropped the Xbox One price over the holidays, attributing to their strong showing. But they are slowing down, which has a lot of Microsoft people worrying. Especially considering how badly they were struggling in the early going to even just find a foothold from a PR standpoint.
Yeah, so that, I mean, they've since continued that price drop, which they still say is temporary, but I think it might be...
It's pretty permanent at this point. It's been temporary for months.
With that, I feel like it's them trying to prolong the only way you seem to be able to get people to get on this console is like, wait, what if it was cheaper than the PS4? What if it had games?
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be doing a good job of selling them. Hey, it's the only console in which you can buy Sonic the Hedgehog. Sunset Overdrive.
Yep. Which is basically Shadow the Hedgehog.
Yeah.
So there you go. Those are your numbers for the three-month period. Please join us again in April for your final tallies, at which point we will reveal that Nintendo somehow stays in the black, Microsoft is sad and crying, and Sony is sitting on a golden throne. Square Enix, meanwhile, this quarter doubled their profits somehow.
No one knows how.
Sorcery. Yeah, dark magic, we can only assume. Just opening a portal to a black dimension.
Tomb Raider is the most popular game in Seagal.
Did you see that the Game Informer Tomb Raider cover is just the Demon Bear cover from New Mutants?
Oh, no, I did not know.
It straight up is. It's just, they could have might as well traced it.
That's pretty awesome. I'm glad they managed to get the Demon Bear in his starring role as he's always... like.
He's actually Lara Croft.
He's actually...
Yeah, Lara Croft just suddenly turns into a bear. Bear Croft.
Bear Croft. All right. Yogi Berra Croft? I don't know. Anyway,
why he's called Yogi Bear. You know that, right?
Yeah, because he's based off Yogi Berra.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. Bear Croft. I'm surprised you haven't killed me yet. Sometimes. Speaking of killing,
we're going to be talking about the game in which you kill yourself to bring up your insides, and that's Persona...
Isn't that how it always works?
Yeah. Kind of. And that's Persona 5, who may have the coolest menus in video games.
Definitely. No, that's not a may. It definitely has the coolest menus in video games.
So we don't really talk about trailers on this show, but man, Persona 5 looks awesome.
I was willing to throw out all our notes and just talk about Persona 5.
That was literally a thing you suggested over Twitter.
Yep.
I'm just going to list the things that I saw in this trailer of this game. So there's a city. There's a train. There's a cat mascot thing. There's a magician dude, a whip lady, and stealth platforming?
Yes.
What is happening?
No, I have no idea. The game's director, Katsura Hashino, left a message on Atlus's website about the game, all in Japanese, but Silicon Era translated it on the internet. Quote, it's about a group of high school students that are being chased by an unexpected occurrence due to the justice they believed in, as opposed to chasing bad guys in prior games. They are being chased by... good guys? Bad guys? They're very clearly vigilantes, and they're thieves.
A prisoner's high school.
They go to a high school called Prison High.
Yeah, and the term they keep using is juvenile...
delinquents.
I think the way they translate it was like this juvenile, just juvenile school, which makes me think they mean juvenile delinquent school.
Yeah. I have a lot. I'm not going to get into all my crazy theories because they're all crazy. But the things that really are interesting to me about this game that we know of kind of hard right now is that, A, it runs on the Catherine engine, which means it's really pretty.
It's really pretty, but also looks like it's from the same year Catherine came out.
Which, I don't have a problem with. Persona 3 and 4 look terrible for 2007 to 2008.
That's true.
But what's interesting about it is that it gets to zoom in the camera a lot more, because the models look good now, as opposed to in Persona 3 and 4. And because of that, they get to have these dynamic camera with the dynamic camera and those dynamic menus. Because that menu was it zooming in on the characters, doing a filter, and then spinning around their model a bunch.
Yeah, so like it would start off with them like leaning back in a really cool way, one direction, and then you'd hit another menu, and then suddenly
they flip around to the other way,
and they're still being cool. Like,
yeah.
Also, this game is, like, riddled with jazz.
There's jazz everywhere. It is a moody heist game. And yeah. all I... Like, the only thing I have strong emotions about in media is moody heists. I really like heists. I think heists are really cool. I think the concept of, like, a plan coming together and a team working out and getting... they steal something in this Robin Hood-y. That stuff's really fun to me. And this is a heist game. You play a bunch of, phantom masked thieves, which is a Japanese concept that comes from the Arsene Lupin stories.
Which are bizarrely popular.
Yeah, in Japan. But the idea is basically you have a thief who wears a mask and he or she sends a note to their target of what they're going to steal before they steal it. And they steal, we don't know what they steal. Hearts. Our hearts.
They've clearly stolen our hearts already, Daniel.
There was this one tweet where it was what each Persona game is. There was like Persona 3 is Sad Teenager Gun Club, Persona 4 is Dumb Teenager Mystery Club, and Persona 5 is Beautiful Teenager Acrobatic Crime Ring.
So the thing I think is most striking and is the most concrete thing we can say before we get into crazy theories is that this game represents a lot of things that we're seeing in the Japanese RPG role-playing game scene, is that it's looks like a recontextualization of earlier JRPG tropes.
Yes, or at the very least, tropes in earlier games within the series that people really didn't like.
So, for instance, in earlier Persona games, one of the things was, hey, are you looking for bland environments that are repetitive and look like they were procedurally generated? Procedurally generated by a computer with both no imagination and artists who have never actually programmed anything interesting that was procedurally generated? Good, because we have two games for you.
Full of them. Yeah. Nonstop.
Do you want to interact with monsters that when in their hallway form, when you're actually able to encounter them, look like puffs with arms detached? We have two games for you.
Literally just slime crawling across the ground.
Yeah. So, like, those games were bad when it came to graphics and displaying their dungeons. Those dungeons were long and boring.
And the thing is, the dungeons feel pointless often because you have a goal and the goal is to get to the end, but the end's pretty nebulous. It's a boss and you don't know where the boss is.
It could be five floors up. It could be three floors up. It could be the next floor. Like,
right.
You could be there forever. Like,
and in Persona 3, you were.
Yeah, because that was just one giant tower, and you could only save every five or something.
Right, but also, every time you re-entered a floor, even if you'd entered before, it got randomly generated again.
Right, so you'd never know where anything was, ever.
Exactly.
So, with this, at least with the heist, it looks like they're taking the idea, they're keeping the idea of a dungeon in that a building with multiple floors that you have to navigate to get to the bottom, or get to the top, or whatever. But they have changed it so that there are actual environments,
right,
as opposed to just pastiches or themes, and they're making it so that there is actually something you might want to do in these situations.
Right. There seems to be a little bit of stealth involved, a little bit of ways to get around enemies or to get advantage over them in fights. We're not really sure how that works.
There's a scene where someone's jumping between chandeliers in what seems to be a dashing motion.
Right, and then there's like a cover mechanic where they're like switching around in a hallway.
It seems more like teleportation or very quick movement as opposed to like actual platforming.
Exactly.
So I'm wondering how contextual this will be versus...
I have a feeling that chandelier thing's a little bit of a puzzle and a little bit of a stealth thing. There's probably a map we're not seeing somewhere that kind of shows you who's looking where, almost like Metal Gear Solid 1.
Right.
But I have a feeling that the chandelier stuff's to get around enemies and the cover system's a little bit of a puzzle. Both are things that would be very welcome in a Persona dungeon because they get monotonous and boring. The reason it's kind of a trend right now in the JRPG design is that Final Fantasy XV is recontextualizing 13's problem, which was hyperlinear dungeons, just hallway dungeons, and recontextualizing that as a road trip, which is something exciting and fun.
It's a similar concept, and really most Final Fantasy games have been fairly linear.
Right.
I mean, you could explore the world, but there weren't that many side quests, and...
Well, it depends on the game, but yeah, mostly.
Most of the games, it was fairly straightforward where you needed to go next, and they were so story-focused that...
Certainly the very popular ones.
Yeah, like 7, 8.
And 13 sort of got rid of a lot of the artifice and literally set its dungeons in hallways.
Yeah, and then as a result, once you narrow it down to that much, it becomes very, very boring.
Right.
So
unless you recontextualize as a fun road trip where anything can happen and there's a million stops along the way, this giant hallway through the world.
Yeah, which is, I mean, that's a cool idea. The idea of like, hey, look, we have a map and we're going somewhere, and that somewhere might be very far away, but here's the road, but here's like, We don't know what's going to happen along the way. It's the same appeal for, like, why people travel across the United States.
And in both cases, you know, we're looking at something that's not necessarily a complete gameplay shift, a very small mechanical shift, if any at all, but a very significant stylistic one.
Yeah.
And the way something's presented. And I feel like very much Persona has always sort of had a lot more style and tried to say a lot more with its style than with its substance.
Right.
And whereas Final Fantasy, I feel like, has been just mired and not knowing what the heck it is for years now. But I definitely feel like I have a feeling that's a really good thing out of Persona. And the style, the aesthetic they're going with is very, very confident.
Yes.
There's a very, like, for all we can say about this trailer, there's not a ton of gameplay in it, though there is quite a bit more than I expected.
There's a fight. We get to see the all-out picture.
We get to see an RPG battle. We get to see dungeon exploration. But the thing that gets me is that there's a very clear, like, they have made an aesthetic choice, and they are going hard with it. Like, they are sticking with it all the way. There's no looking back with what they're going with right now. And what they're going with is JoJo's Bizarre Adventure meets Gone Guy.
I mean, both of which are pretty obscure to this, unless you watch a ton of anime.
Sure, but, you know, you're playing Persona 5.
You are. That's true. If you're playing Persona 5, then it is your duty as
You've at least encountered one of these things.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's weird how much buffer of a characters. I mean, they're still kind of lanky anime dudes, but they look, their personas are like,
they're a little bit more realistically proportioned, I feel.
Yeah, they're more realistic.
Their heads aren't quite as giant.
Yeah, and I feel that might be something to do with the fact that they're running off the Catherine engine, and so, like, they don't have to make their anime representations be kind of cute and chibi to be, like, not super dissonant to the characters on screen.
And part of that, too, I think, is definitely that now they have the technology and the money to make nicer models, and at that point you can zoom in closer, and if you zoom in close on the Persona 4 models, they look awful, as evidenced by some things in Persona 4 the Golden.
Oh, I love Persona 4 when the characters basically look like they looked at Final Fantasy 7 and said, we can do better than that.
Yeah, well, I mean, again, I understand where it came from. They didn't have money. Those are tiny budget games. And I mean, to be fair, this game is running on an engine from 2008, 2009. Like, it's not a huge budget game either, but it is a medium-sized budget. It's a small to medium-sized budget game now, running with a whole bunch of technology that's already done, so it can afford to look a lot better than it would otherwise. And I think having that consistent aesthetic makes it look a lot nicer than a lot of games we're seeing these days.
I agree. And it just feels, at the very least, it looks like it's coming together as a coherent map of whatever they're trying to build. It looks like they're being smart about it, and that's probably the most confident thing you can say about that game.
Right. And so now we can talk about crazy theories.
All right, so you have, I personally think that, so my crazy theory is that, so they're taking off masks, when you see them in battle, they're taking off masks to kind of unleash their persona, and they're turning into personas, right?
Mm-hmm. So, or at least, there's a scene at the very end of the trailer where the main character takes off he has blood on his face, and then the blood, like, turns into the blue fire that summons personas, and you hear the persona summoning noise, which very much implies that he's turning into his persona.
Right, so this is very much Digimon Season 5, very much. But my belief with this is, like, what's going on is they are actually personas the whole time. The masks are making them look human, and they are fighting against something within the persona world. Mm-hmm. And they are fighting maybe against other personas, or maybe against demons, or maybe against shadows or something. And they don't necessarily have human hosts. This might be a little crazy because, I mean, like, Igor has evolved, so it has to be something to do with the wild card in here.
Right.
But I feel like the idea of having the persona, because in previous games what they had was, like, you either ripped a tarot card or you shot yourself in the face.
Mm-hmm.
And this one seems even, like, less violent than either of those.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's something more to do with transformation than it is to
See,
do necessarily.
My only what you said, like, so I had a problem with it for a second there, whereas the mask traditionally in Persona represents the persona.
Right.
And by taking off the mask, I think actually very much it implies that them wearing the mask is their persona and taking off is their true self.
Right.
Because the persona is you removing your mask. That's sort of what it's always been. The mask represents the act of of releasing your persona.
Right.
Which is why I don't necessarily think they're personas. But you said something there at the end, what was it? Not the act of transformation, but right before that, the idea that they are fighting something within that world, the idea that there is something that they're changing. I think that what it is, now that you say that, and it kind of ties into my crazy theory about the guilt stuff, I think that the personas very much represent their core guilt thing, something they're guilty about. I think that they are...
That would be really cool. So, like, because in previous trailers, they've just shown characters, like, In chains?
In chains. The main character's in prison in this trailer a lot. He's wearing, like, prisoner uniforms, and they're behind bars. The Igor. School is called Prison High School. Igor in the Velvet Room is in a jail cell now. I think, and this sort of ties into my theory that I'll get into in a second about this. I'll get to the Seven Deadly Sin thing, then I'll come around. I think that where Persona 3's theme was Greek mythology, Persona 4's was Japanese mythology, I think this one's very Catholic. I think there's a lot of implications of guilt and absolution and being free of your guilt in this. And I think that the your party is built around the Seven Deadly Sins. And I think in that case, their persona represents their something they're guilty of, some crime they've committed that has landed them in this, like, juvenile delinquent institution.
Right.
And in that case, their goal essentially is not to absolve themselves of their sin, because I think that's not quite what persona would do. It's more about to accept the fact that they have done something bad in their life.
Right.
And not to seek forgiveness so much as acceptance. And basically, that deadly sin would essentially become its opposite element.
Huh.
Anger would become kindness or something. Greed would become generosity. And I feel like their personas that we're seeing in the trailer, the reason they're turning into their persona, maybe it's just the way it works in this game, but I think what it is, that it is because they're completely overcome by this guilt, this deadly sin.
That would make sense. That would be really cool. Yeah.
Or you've been a shadow, that you're a shadow fighting personas. That also seems cool.
All of this is crazy nonsense, and we have no idea really what's going on in this game. For Persona games, the Shin Megami Tensei games, which, I mean, this is technically still a part, have such a varied method of gameplay and structure that Persona taking a leap into the beyond wouldn't be a massive surprise.
It also definitely seems from this trailer they're going a little bit more SMTE. You're fighting, instead of fighting the shadows that we mentioned earlier, you are fighting actual personas,
right,
or demons in the SMT universe. And by the way, the 3D models look really pretty. Like, HD Sandman is really gorgeous. But you're not fighting shadows, you're fighting personas, which lends some credence to them being shadows of some kind.
Right.
I would actually kind of be really interested if maybe more people in this world were Persona users and you're beating up other people's personas.
So, like, one theory that I had was maybe, like, C's or whatever from Persona 3. They're hunting you down because you're, like, renegade Persona users.
Mm-hmm.
You're vigilantes, like, disrupting whatever crazy system is going on.
Yeah.
Which could be interesting. It would be an interesting way to tie this game back into the previous three games, especially as they're all being tied into Persona 2 for some reason.
Right, yeah. They're very, very closely linked to Persona 2. Crazily.
So, hey, maybe this is just, you know, or maybe they're just going to go back and say it's a prequel to If. That would be weird.
That'd be really weird. I just want to point out that if you want to know how crazy my Seven Deadly Sins theory gets, and I mentioned this to Arbonne before, their eyes change color to colors associated with the Deadly Sins when they enter the Shadow World.
Right. So each color represents a given
main character
sin.
Is red. The girl, Anne, or Anzu, it depends how you want to read the kanji, is green. The bro character, who seems to represent the tradition like magician arcana, is yellow. And the cat, Morgana, is blue.
I thought you were going to represent the traditional douchebag, but okay.
Traditional douchebag, yeah. I feel like we're missing, in that case, what are the deadly things? We've got wrath, we've got envy, we've got greed, we've got lust. Gluttony?
Yeah. Pride,
and there's one more. Think back to Fullmetal
Alchemist. So that's what I'm going through. All
Sloth.
The Sloth, that was it.
Oh, man. Okay, so we've got... So Sloth is going to be like a tank.
Yeah. But no, are we talking manga or anime?
No, well...
Oh, that's two the deep cuts. Anyway, so Persona 5 looks like a good game. Looks like a good game, guys.
I'm so mad right now.
Speaking of things...
It's killed my buzz.
Speaking of things that we like, soon when you can't load the Grand Budapest Hotel, it'll be because your internet sucks and not because there's a corporate conspiracy slowing down your internet.
This week, the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission announced that he was going to reclassify ISPs as common carriers in the U.S.
So what that means for American citizens is that internet service providers will be under Title II of the Telecommunications Act. Basically, no one can act as a fast lane for their own Netflix competitor. And you can't count and you can't say, like, oh, my own. Here's my fake Comcast station. You can doesn't count against like whatever your 300.
You can't
gigabyte.
Use, for example, just here in Canada, Bell can't say Crave TV doesn't cost you any data.
Yeah, exactly. Which I think it might have as a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't slow competitors down. Pretty simple.
Yep. It's very simple. As long as it's lawful, you also can't throttle anyone's usage, even if it's on a mobile network wireless plan. So you can't actually tell Netflix that they have to pay up if they don't want to be slower for everybody else.
Yeah, and which is totally fascinating. And also, this is going to apply to, like, originally, mobile internet was under a different set of rules because mobile internet it requires satellites, and the claims are basically it's a much more difficult process to get the internet into the phone. And because of that, it's a lot more expensive per data, right? Mm-hmm. It's not wires, it's free air. So those are previously exempt rules. And if you had an unlimited plan or a legacy plan that got you, like, unlimited data, you usually, and you said, hey, I want to use Netflix on your phone for some reason, mm-hmm. You would get throttled pretty bad because they don't want you to use Netflix on your phone.
That's
also illegal.
Yeah. While this stuff has to go through a voting stage and U.S. Congress could stop it from passing, things look pretty good for now. Meanwhile, up here in the north.
So the Canadian
Radio and Television Commission.
Telecommunications Commission.
Telecommunications, sorry.
Yes. He's similar ruling this week and straight up said no fast lanes and no slow lanes.
Bell and Videotron were offering their mobile TV services without affecting their own data cap on phones, which is cheating. A competitor doesn't get that ability.
Basically, like, if a Canadian competitor to Netflix wanted to pop up that wasn't sponsored by these massive corporations, say, hey, here's, like, this massive supply of movies or TV shows or every episode in Kids in the Hall, they would count under the data cap, and because of that, it would hamper any kind of future innovation in mm-hmm. this country. And that's kind of like why net neutrality is a good thing, guys.
Yeah.
So because it's Canada, the ruling is kind of arcane, though.
Yeah, it's hard to tell whether it just applies to mobile or to what extent the CRTC will enforce net neutrality. But whatever, let's take it as a win.
Until someone sues, or Republicans get involved, or Stephen Harper decides we desperately need to see heroes through a monopolistic business practice, things are looking pretty good.
Yeah, things are looking up for net neutrality.
Yeah.
Everybody's all for it.
Everybody's all for it. And the thing that I find most amazing about this was about a year ago, we were all incredibly depressed about net neutrality.
Yeah. This is a nice big turnaround. I think it's thanks to Persona 5.
If he says Persona 5, one of the many things that we can thank. So the original chairman, Tom Wheeler, he used to work for a lot of the big companies. Mm-hmm. And because of that, he was seen as a bit of a stooge.
Yeah.
And I think he's still considered, kind of. But the thing that I found interesting was, like, he's the one apparently who's put forward this plan, although I think we can really thank John Oliver.
Yeah, we can really thank John Oliver for calling him a dingo babysitter.
Oh man, I like that he had to go out and say that he was not a dingo on C-SPAN.
One of those beautiful moments in C-SPAN history, next to Howard Lincoln and Tom Kalinske, like, pointing light guns at each other across the Senate floor.
Did that happen?
Yeah, when the Senate had hearings on video game violence in the 90s and ended up creating the ESRB, and they were just, like, shaking light guns at each other.
Well, the origins of the video game industry, as important as ever. That's it for news. You've been listening to Built to Play. That's all for this week. I'm producer Amin Iqbali.
And I'm features editor Daniel Rosen.
We're available on Stitcher Radio and iTunes. Leave us a review so we know how we're doing and where we can find the show.
We're usually in the air at the Scope at Ryerson at 1 p.m. with a new episode on Saturdays.
Make sure to follow us on Twitter at Built to Play or at our website. That's at builttoplay.ca. You can also follow me personally at Flarkon. That's at FLRKCOM.
And I'm at Daniel_Rosen. And remember, it's okay if Thomas Walker is your persona. Thank you so much for listening.